the work. Besides, I used to enjoy listening to them when we were on Dallas. Signal from Asheville, a communications specialist reported from the door. They've acquired their target. Well, they're pretty good, Jones said, looking down at the plot. But we're still the big kid on the block. Air Force One floated into the usual soft landing at Sheremetyevo Airport 1 minute early. There was a collective sigh as the thrust reversers cut in, slowing the heavy aircraft rapidly. Soon everyone started hearing the click of seatbelts coming off. What woke you up so early? Kathy asked her husband. Political stuff at home. I guess I can tell you now. Ryan explained on, then remembered he had the fax still folded in his pocket. He handed it over, cautioning his wife that it wasn't all true. I always thought he was slimy. She handed it back. Oh, don't you remember when he was the conscience of Congress? Jack asked quietly. Maybe he was, but I never thought he had one of his own. Just remember, if anybody asks, I'm a surgeon here to meet with my Russian colleagues and do a little sightseeing. Which was entirely true. The state trip would make considerable demands on Ryan's time and his capacity as a senior presidential advisor, but it wasn't all that different from a normal family vacation either. Their tastes in sightseeing overlapped, but didn't entirely coincide, and Kathy knew that her husband loathed shopping in any form. It was something odd about men in general, and her husband in particular. The aircraft turned onto the taxiway, and things started to happen. President and Mrs. Durling emerged from their compartment, all ready to present themselves as the embodiment of their country. People remained seated to let them pass, aided by the intimidating presence of both Secret Service and Air Force security people. Hell of a job, Ryan breathed, watching the president put on his happy face, and knowing that it was at least partially a lie. He had to do so many things and make each appear as though it were the only thing he had to do. He had to compartmentalize everything. When on one task, to pretend that the others didn't exist. Maybe, like Kathy and her patients, wasn't that an interesting thought? They heard band music when the door opened, the local version of Ruffles and Flourishes. I guess we can get up now. The protocol was already established. People hunched at the windows to watch the president reach the bottom of the steps, shake hands with the new Russian president and the U.S. ambassador to the Russian Republic. The rest of the official party then went down the steps while the press deplaned from the after door. It was very different from Ryan's last trip to Moscow. The airport was the same, but the time of day, the weather, and the whole atmosphere could not have been more different. It only took one face to make that clear, that of Sergei Nikolaevich Golovko, chairman of the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, who stood behind the front rank of dignitaries. In the old days, he would not have shown his face at all, but now his blue eyes were aimed right at Ryan, and they twinkled with mirth as Jack led his wife down the stairs and to their place at the bottom. The initial signs were a little scary, as was not unusual when political factors interfered with economic forces. Organized labor was flexing its muscles and doing it cleverly for the first time in years. In cars and their associated components alone, it was possible that hundreds of thousands of jobs would be coming back to the fold. The arithmetic was straightforward. Nearly $90 billion of products had arrived from overseas in the last year and would now have to be produced domestically. Sitting down with their management counterparts, labor came to the collective decision that the only thing missing was the government's word that TRA would not be a paper tiger soon to be cast away in the name of international amity. To get that assurance, however, they had to work Congress, so the lobbying was already underway, backed by the realization that the election cycle was coming up. Congress could not do one thing with one hand and something else with the other. Promises were made and action taken, and for once both crossed party lines. The media were already commenting on how well it was working. It wasn't just a matter of hiring employees. There would have to be a huge increase in capacity. Old plants and those operating under their capacity would need to be upgraded, and so preliminary orders were put in for tooling and materials. The instant surge came as something of a surprise, despite all the warnings, because despite their expertise, even the most astute observers had not seen the bill for the revolution it really was. But the blip on the statistical reports was unmistakable. The Federal Reserve kept all manner of measuring criteria on the American economy, and one of them was orders for such things as steel and machine tools. The period during which TRA had traveled through Congress and to the White House had seen a jump so large as to be off the graph paper. Then the governors saw a vast leap in short-term borrowing, largely from auto-related industries that had to finance their purchases from various specialty suppliers. The rise in orders was inflationary, and inflation was already a long-standing concern. The rise in borrowing would deplete the supply of money that could be borrowed. That had to be stopped, and quickly. The governors decided that instead of the quarter-point rise in the discount rate that they had already approved, and word of which had already leaked, the jump would be a full half-point, to be announced at close of business the following day. Commander Ugaki was in the control room of his submarine, as usual, chain-smoking and drinking copious amounts of tea that occasioned hourly trips to his cabin and its private head, not to mention hacking coughs that were exacerbated by the dehumidified air, kept unusually dry to protect onboard electronic systems. He knew they had to be out there, at least one, perhaps two, American submarines, Charlotte and Asheville, his intelligence briefs had told him. But it wasn't the boats he feared, it was the crews. The American submarine force had been reduced drastically in size, but evidently not in quality. He'd expected to detect his adversary for Dateline partners hours before. Perhaps, Ugaki told himself, they hadn't even had a sniff of him yet. But he wasn't sure of that, and over the past 36 hours he'd come fully to the realization that this was no longer a game, not since he'd received the code phrase, "Climb Mount Niitaka." How confident he had been a week earlier, but now he was at sea and underwater. The transition from theory to reality was striking. "Anything?" he asked his sonar officer, getting a headshake for an answer. Ordinarily, an American sub on an exercise like this was augmented, meaning that a sound source was switched on, which increased the amount of radiated noise she put in the water. Done to simulate the task of detecting a Russian submarine, it was in one way arrogant and in another way very clever of the Americans. They so rarely played against allies or even their own forces at the level of their true capabilities that they had learned to operate under a handicap, like a runner with weighted shoes. As a result, when they played a game without the handicap, they were formidable indeed. "Well, so am I," Ugaki told himself. Hadn't he grown up tracking Russian subs like the Americans? Hadn't he gotten in close of a Russian Akula? Patience. The true samurai is patient. This was not a task for a merchant, after all. "It is like tracking whales, isn't it?" Commander Steve Kennedy observed. "Pretty close," sonar man First Class Jacques-Yves Laval, Jr. replied quietly, watching his display and rubbing his ears, sweaty from the headphones. "You feel cheated?" "My dad got to play the real game. All I ever heard growing up, sir, was what he could tell me about going up north and stalking the big boys on their own turf." Frenchy Laval was a name well known in the submarine community, a great sonar man who trained other great sonar men. Now retired as a master chief, his son carried on the tradition. The hell of it was, tracking whales had turned out to be good training. They were stealthy creatures, not because they sought to avoid detection, but simply because they moved with great efficiency, and the submarines had found that moving in close enough to count and identify the members of individual pods or families was at least diverting, if not exactly exciting. For the sonar men, anyway, Kennedy thought. Not much for weapons department. Laval's eyes focused on the waterfall display. He settled more squarely into his chair and reached for a grease pencil, tapping the third class next to him. 270, he said quietly.
Yeah.
What you got, Junior? The CO asked.
Just a sniff, sir, on the 60 hertz line.
30 seconds later.
Firming up. Kennedy stood behind the two watchstanders. There were now two dotted lines, one in the 60 hertz frequency portion of the display, another on a higher frequency band. The electric motors on the Japanese Horushio-class submarine used 60-cycle AC electrical current. An irregular series of dots, yellow on the dark screen, started cascading down in a column under the 60 frequency heading, like droplets falling in slow motion from a leaky faucet, hence the appellation waterfall display. Junior Laval let it grow for a few more seconds to see if it might be random, and decided that it was probably not.
Sir, I think we might want to start a track now. Designate this contact Sierra 1, possible submerged contact, bearing settling down on 274, strength is weak.
Kennedy relayed the information to the fire control tracking party 15 feet away. Another technician activated the RayPath analyzer, a high-end Hewlett-Packard mini-computer programmed to examine the possible paths through the water that the identified acoustical signal might have followed. Though widely known to exist, the high-speed software for this piece of kit was still one of the Navy's most closely held secrets, a product Kennedy remembered of Sonosystems, a Groton-based company run by one of Frenchy Laval's top protégés. The computer chewed on the input data for perhaps 1,000 microseconds and displayed its reply.
Sir, it's direct path. My initial range estimate is between 8 and 12,000 yards.
Set it up, the approach officer told the petty officer on the fire control director.
This one ain't no humpback, Laval reported 3 minutes later. I have three lines on the guy now. Classify Sierra 1 as a definite submarine contact operating on his electric motors.
Junior told himself that Laval Pear had made his rep stalking hen-class Russian subs, which were about as hard to track as an earthquake. He adjusted his headphones. Bearing steady at 274, getting hints of a blade rate on the guy.
Solution light, the lead fire controlman reported. I have a valid solution for tube 3 on target Sierra 1.
Left 10 degrees rudder, come to new course 180, Kennedy ordered next to get a cross bearing, from which would come a better range gate on the target, and also data on the sub's course and speed.
Let's slow her down. Turns for 5 knots.
The stalk was always the fun part.
If you do that, you're cutting your own throat with a dull knife, Anne Quinlan said in her customarily direct way.
Keelty was sitting in his office. Ordinarily, the number two man in any organization would be in charge when number one was away, but the miracle of modern communications meant that Roger could do everything he needed to do at midnight over Antarctica if he had to, including putting out a press statement from his aircraft in Moscow that he was hanging his vice president out to dry. Keelty's first instinct was to proclaim to the entire world that he knew he had the confidence of his president. That would hint broadly that the news stories were true and muddy the water sufficiently to give him room to maneuver, the thing he needed most of all.
What we need to know, Ed, his chief of staff pointed out, not for the first time, is who the hell started this.
That was the one thing the story had left out, clever people that reporters were. She couldn't ask him how many of the women in his office he'd visited with his charms. For one thing, he probably didn't remember, and for another, the hard part would be identifying those he hadn't.
Whoever it was somebody close to Lisa, another staffer observed. That insight made light bulbs flash inside every head in the office.
Barbara.
Good guess, the chief, which was how Quinlan liked to be identified, thought.
We need to confirm that, and we need to settle her down some.
Woman scorned, Keelty murmured.
Ed, I don't want to hear any of that, okay? The chief warned.
When the hell are you going to learn that no doesn't mean maybe later?
Okay, I'll go see Barbara myself, and maybe we can talk her out of this, but goddammit, this is the last time, okay?
Chapter 18. Easter Egg.
Is this where the dresser was? Ryan asked.
I keep forgetting how well informed you are, Golovko observed, just to flatter his guest, since the story was actually widely known.
Jack grinned, still feeling more than a little of Alice through the looking glass.
There was a completely ordinary door in the wall now, but until the time of Yuri Andropov, a large wooden clothes cabinet had covered it, for in the time of Beria and the rest, the entrance to the office of chairman of the KGB had to be hidden. There was no door off the main corridor, and none visible even in the anteroom. The melodrama of it had to have been absurd, Ryan thought, even to Lavrenti Beria, whose morbid fear of assassination, though hardly unreasonable, had dreamed up this obtuse security measure. It hadn't helped him avoid death at the hands of men who'd hated him even more than they'd feared him. Still and all, wasn't it bizarre enough just for the President's National Security Advisor to enter the office of the chairman of the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service? Beria's ashes must have been stirring up somewhere, Ryan thought, in whatever sewer they dropped the urn. He turned to look at his host, his mind imagining the Oak Bureau still, and halfway wishing they'd kept the old name of KGB, Committee for State Security, just for tradition's sake. Sergei Nikolaevich, has the world really changed so much in the past? God, only 10 years? Not even that, my friend. Golovko waved Jack to a comfortable leather chair that dated back to the building's previous incarnation as home office of the Rossiya Insurance Company. And yet we have so far to go. Business, Jack thought. Well, Sergei had never been bashful about that. Ryan remembered looking into the wrong end of a pistol in this man's hand, but that had all taken place before the so-called end of history. I'm doing everything I can, Sergei. We got you the $5 billion for the missiles. That was a nice scam you ran on us, by the way. Ryan checked his watch. The ceremony was scheduled for the evening. 1 minute man 3 and 1 SS-19 left, if you didn't count the SS-19s in Japan that had been reconfigured to launch satellites. We have many problems, Jack. Fewer than a year ago, Ryan observed, wondering what the next request would be. I know you advise President Grushevoy on more than just intelligence matters. Come on, Sergei, things are getting better, you know that. Nobody ever told us that democracy would be so hard. It's hard for us, too, pal. We rediscover it every day. The frustration is that we know we have everything we need to make our country prosperous. The problem is in making everything work. Yes, I advise my president on many things. Sergei, if you're not one of the best informed people in your country, I would be very surprised. Yes. Well, we are surveying eastern Siberia. So many things, so many resources. We have to hire Japanese to do it for us, but what they are finding. His voice trailed off. You're building up to something, Sergei. What is it? We think they do not tell us everything. We dug up some surveys done in the early 30s. They were in archives in the Ministry of the Interior. A deposit of gadolinium in an unlikely place. At the time, there were few uses for that metal, and it was forgotten until some of my people did a detailed search of old data. Gadolinium now has many uses, and one of their survey teams camped within a few kilometers of the deposit. We know it's real. The 30s team brought back samples for assay, but it was not included in their last report. And? Jack asked. And I find it curious that they lied to us on this, Golovko observed, taking his time. You didn't build up to a play like this all that quickly. How are you paying them for the work? The agreement is that they will assist us in the exploitation of many of the things they find for us. The terms are generous. Why would they lie? Ryan inquired. Golovko shook his head. I do not know. It might be important to find out. You are a student of history, are you not? It was one of the things that each respected about the other. Ryan might have written off Golovko's concerns as yet another example of Russian paranoia. Sometimes he thought that the entire concept had been invented in this country, but that would have been unfair. Russia had fought Japan under the Tsar in 1904-1905 and lost, along the way giving the Japanese Navy a landmark victory at the Battle of the Tsushima Strait. The war had gone a long way toward destroying the Romanovs,
and to elevating Japan to world power status, which had led to their involvement in two world wars. It had also inflicted a bleeding sore on the Russian psyche that Stalin had remembered well enough to recover the lost territories. The Japanese had also been involved in post-World War I efforts to topple the Bolsheviks. They'd put a sizable army into Siberia and hadn't been all that enthusiastic about withdrawing it. The same thing had happened again in 1938 and 1939 with more serious consequences this time, first at the hands of Marshal Blücher, then a guy named Zhukov. Yes, there was much history between Russia and Japan. "In this day and age, Sergei?" Ryan asked with a wry expression. "You know, Jack, as bright a chap as you are still an American, and your experience with invasions is far less serious than ours. Are we panicked about this? No, of course not. Is it something worthy of close attention? Yes, Ivan Nemetovich, it is." He was clearly building up to something, and with all the time he'd taken, it had to be something big, Ryan thought. Time to find out what it was. "Well, Sergei Nikolaevich, I suppose I can understand your concern, but there isn't very much I can..." Golovko cut him off with a single word. "Thistle. Lyalin's old network? What about it?" "You have recently reactivated it." The chairman of RVS saw that Ryan had the good grace to blink in surprise. A bright, serious man, Ryan, but still not really someone who would have made a good field officer. His emotions were just too open. Perhaps Sergei thought he should read a book on Ireland, the better to understand the player in the ancient leather chair. Ryan had strengths and weaknesses, neither of which he completely understood. "What gives you that idea?" the American asked, as innocently as he could, knowing that he'd reacted, again, baited by this clever old pro. He saw Golovko smile at his discomfort and wondered if the liberalization of this country had allowed people to develop a better sense of humor. Before, Golovko would have just stared impassively. "Jack, we are professionals, are we not? I know this. How I know it is my concern. I don't know what cards you're holding, my friend, but before you go any further, we need to decide if this is a friendly game or not. As you know, the real Japanese counterintelligence agency is the Public Safety Investigation Division of their Justice Ministry." The expositional statement was as clear as it had to be and was probably truthful. It also defined the terms of the discourse. This was a friendly game. Golovko had just revealed a secret of his own, though not a surprising one. You had to admire the Russians. Their expertise in the espionage business was world-class. No, Ryan corrected himself. They were the class of the world. What better way to run agents in any foreign country than first to establish a network within the country's counterintelligence services? There was still the lingering suspicion that they had in fact controlled MI5, Britain's security service, for some years, and their deep and thorough penetration of CIA's own internal security arm was still an embarrassment to America. "Make your play," Ryan said. "Check to the dealer." "You'll have two field officers in Japan covered as Russian journalists. They are reactivating the network. They are very good and very careful, but one of their contacts is compromised by PSID. That can happen to anyone," Golovko observed fairly. He didn't even gloat, Jack saw. Well, he was too professional for that, and it was a fairly friendly game by most standards. The other side of the statement was as clear as it could be. With a simple gesture, Sergei was in a position to burn Clark and Chavez, creating yet another international incident between two countries that had enough problems to settle. That was why Golovko didn't gloat. He didn't have to. Ryan nodded. "Okay, pal, I just folded. Tell me what you want." "We would like to know why Japan is lying to us and anything else that, in Mrs. Foley's opinion, might be of interest to us. In return, we are in a position to protect the network for you." He didn't add, "for the time being." "How much do they know?" Jack asked, considering the spoken offer. Golovko was suggesting that Russia cover an American intelligence operation. It was something new, totally unprecedented. They put a very high value on the information that might be developed. High as hell, Jack thought. Why?
Enough to expel them from the country, no more. Golovko opened a drawer and handed over a sheet of paper. This is all Falieva needs to know.
Jack read and pocketed it. My country has no desire to see any sort of conflict between Russia and Japan.
Then we are agreed.
Yes, Sergei. I will recommend approval of your suggestion.
As always, Ivan Emetovich, a pleasure to do business with you.
Why didn't you activate it yourself? Ryan asked, wondering how badly rolled he'd been that day.
Lialin held out on the information. Clever of him. We didn't have enough time to persuade him to give it over before we gave him to your custody.
Such a nice turn of phrase, Jack thought. Persuade. Well, Golovko had come up under the old system. It was too much to expect that he would have been entirely divorced from it. Jack managed to grin.
You know, you were great enemies.
And with Golovko's single suggestion, Jack thought behind clinically impassive eyes, perhaps now there would be the beginning of something else. Damn, how much crazier would this world get? It was 6 hours later in Tokyo and 8 hours earlier in New York. The 14-hour differential and the international dateline created many opportunities for confusion. It was Saturday the 14th in some places and Friday in others. At 3 in the morning, Chuck Searles left his home for the last time. He'd rented a car the previous day. Like many New Yorkers, he had never troubled himself to purchase one for the drive to LaGuardia. The Delta terminal was surprisingly full for the first flight of the day to Atlanta. He'd booked a ticket through one of the city's many travel agencies and paid cash for the assumed name he would hereafter be using from time to time, which was not the same as the one on the passport he had also acquired a few months ago. Sitting in 2A, a first-class seat whose wide expanse allowed him to turn slightly and lean his head back, he slept most of the way to Atlanta, where his baggage was transferred to a flight to Miami. There wasn't much, really. 2 lightweight suits, some shirts, and other immediate necessities, plus his laptop computer. In Miami, he'd board another flight under another name and head southeast to Paradise. George Winston, former head of the Columbus Group, was not a happy man, despite the plush surroundings of his home in Aspen. A wrenched knee saw to that. Though he now had the time to indulge his newly discovered passion for skiing, he was a little too inexperienced, and perhaps a little too old to use the expert slopes. It hurt like a son of a bitch. He rose from his bed at 3 in the morning and limped into the bathroom for another dose of the painkiller the doctor had prescribed. Once there, he found that the combination of wakefulness and lingering pain offered little hope of returning to sleep. It was just after 5 in New York, he thought, about the time he usually got up, always early to get a jump on the late risers, checking his computer and the journal and other sources of information so that he could be fully prepared for his opening moves on the market. He missed it, Winston admitted to himself. It was a hell of a thing to say to the face in the mirror. Okay, so he'd worked too hard, alienated himself from his own family, driven himself into a state little different from drug addiction. But getting out was a mistake. Well, no, not exactly that, he thought, hobbling into his den as quietly as he could manage. It was just that you couldn't empty something and then attempt to fill it with nothing, could you? He couldn't sail his Cristobal all the time, not with kids in school. In fact, there was only one thing in his life that he'd been able to do all the time, and that had damn near killed him, hadn't it? Even so. Damn, you couldn't even get the journal out here at a decent hour. And this was civilization? Fortunately, they did have phone lines. Just for old time's sake, he switched on his computer. Winston was wired into nearly every news and financial service there was, and he selected his personal favorite. It was good to do it early in the morning. His wife would yell again if she saw him up to his old tricks, which meant that he was nowhere near as current on the street as he liked to be, player or not. Well, okay, he had a few hours, and it wasn't as though he'd be riding a helicopter to the top of the mountain at dawn, was it? No skiing at all, the doc had told him firmly, not for at least a week,
and then he'd confine himself to the bumpy slopes. It wouldn't look that bad, would it? He'd pretend to be teaching his kids. Damn. He'd gotten out too soon. No way he could have known, of course, but in the last few weeks the market had begged aloud for a person with his talents to swoop down and make his moves. He would have moved on steel 3 weeks ago, made his killing, and then moved on to silicon alchemy. Yeah, that was one he would have snapped up in one big hurry. They had invented a new sort of screen for laptop computers, and now, with Japan's products under a cloud, the issue had exploded. Who was it who'd quarterback the IPO, that Ryan guy? Good instincts for the business. Pissing away his time in government service now. What a waste of talent, Winston told himself, feeling the ache in his leg and trying not to add that he was pissing away his time in the middle of the night at a ski resort he couldn't use for the next week at best. Everything on the street seemed so unnecessarily shaky, he thought, checking trend lines on stocks he considered good if stealthy bellwethers. That was one of the tricks, spotting trends and indicators before the others did. One of the tricks? Hell, the only trick. How he did it was surprisingly hard to teach. He supposed that it was the same in any field. Some people just did it, and he was one of them. Others tried to do the same by cheating, seeking out information in underhanded ways or by falsely creating trends that they could then exploit. But that was cheating, wasn't it? And what was the point of making money that way? Beating the others fairly and at their own game, that was the real art of trading. And at the end of the day, what he liked to hear was the way others would come up and say, "You son of a bitch." The tone of the comment made all the difference. There was no reason for the market to be so unsteady, he thought. People hadn't thought the things through, that was all. The Hornets went off behind the first wave of Tomcats. Sanchez taxied his fighter to the starboard side bowcat, feeling the tow bar that formed part of his nosewheel gear slip into the proper slot on the shuttle. His heavily loaded fighter shuddered at full power as the deck crewman gave the aircraft a last visual check. Satisfied, the catapult officer made the ready signal, and Sanchez fired off a salute and set his head back on the back of his ejection seat. A moment later, steam power flung him off the bow and into the air. The Hornet settled a bit, a feeling that was never entirely routine, and he climbed into the sky, retracting his landing gear and heading toward the rendezvous point, his wings heavy with fuel tanks and blue practice missiles. They were trying to be clever and almost succeeding, but almost didn't really count in this game. Satellite photos had revealed the presence of the three inbound surface groups. Sanchez would lead the Alpha Strike against the big one, 8 ships, all tin cans. 2 separated pairs of Tomcats would deal with the P-3s they had out. For the first time, they'd hunt actively with their search radars, instead of being under MCOM. It would be a single rapier thrust. No, more the descending blow of a big and heavy club. Intermittent sweeps of an E-2C Hawkeye radar aircraft determined that the Japanese had not deployed fighters to Marcus, which would have been clever, if difficult for them, and in any case they would not have been able to surge enough of them to matter, not against 2 full carrier air wings. Marcus just wasn't a big enough island, as Saipan or Guam was. That was his last abstract thought for a while. On Bud's command, via a low-power radio circuit, the formation began to disperse according to its carefully structured plan. "Hi." Sato lifted the growler phone on Mutsu's bridge. "We just detected low-power radio voice traffic, 2 signals, bearing 157 and 195 respectively. "It's about time," Sato told his group operations officer. "I thought they'd never get around to their attack." In a real war situation, he would do one thing. In this particular case, he'd do another. There was little point in letting the Americans know the sensitivity of his Elint gear. "Continue as before." "Very well. We still have the 2 airborne radars. They appear to be flying racetrack patterns. No change." "Thank you." Sato replaced the phone and reached for his tea. His best technicians were working the electronic intelligence listening gear, and they had tapes collecting the information taken down by every sensor for later study.
That was really the important part of this phase of the exercise, to learn all they could about how the U.S. Navy made its deliberate attacks.
"Action stations?" Mutsu's captain asked quietly.
"No need," the admiral replied, staring thoughtfully at the horizon as he supposed a fighting sailor did.
Aboard Snoopy 1 and EA-6B Prowler, the flight crew monitored all radar and radio frequencies. They found and identified 6 commercial-type search radars, none of them close to the known location of the Japanese formation. They weren't making it much of a contest, everyone thought. Normally, these games were a lot more fun.
The captain of the port at Tanapag Harbor looked out from his office to see a large car carrier working her way around the southern tip of Managaha Island. That was a surprise. He ruffled through the papers on his desk to see where the telex was to warn him of her arrival.
Ah, yes, there. It must have come in during the night. MV Orchid Ace out of Yokohama. Cargo of Toyota Land Cruisers diverted for sale to the local Japanese landowners. Probably a ship that had been scheduled for transit to America. So now the cars would come here and clog the local roads some more. He grumped and lifted his binoculars to give her a look and saw, to his surprise, another lump on the horizon, large and foxy.
Another car carrier?
That was odd.
Snoopy 1 held position and altitude just under the visual horizon from the enemy formation about 100 miles away. The electronic warriors in the 2 back seats had their hands ready on the power switches for the onboard jammers, but the Japanese didn't have any of their radars up, and there was nothing to jam. The pilot allowed herself a look to the southeast and saw a few flashes, yellow glints off the gold-impregnated canopies of the inbound Alpha Strike, which was now angling down to the deck to stay out of radar coverage as long as possible before popping up to loose their first salvo of administrative missiles.
"Tango, tango, tango," Commander Steve Kennedy said into the Gertrude, giving the code word for a theoretical or administrative torpedo launch. He'd held contact with the Horushio class for 9 hours, taking the time to get acquainted with the contact and to get his crew used to something more demanding than getting heartbeats on a pregnant humpback. Finally bored with the game, it was time to light up the underwater telephone, and he was sure scare the bejeebers out of Sierra One after giving him ample time to counter-detect. He didn't want anyone to say later that he hadn't given the other guy a fair break. Not that this sort of thing was supposed to be fair, but Japan and America were friends, despite the news stuff they'd been getting on the radio for the past few weeks.
"Took his time," Commander Ugaki said. They'd tracked the American 688 for almost 40 minutes, so they were good, but not that good. It had been so hard for them to detect Karushio that they'd made their attack as soon as they had a track, and Ugaki thought he'd let them have their first shot. So, the CO looked at his own fire control director and the 4 red solution lights. He lifted his own Gertrude phone to reply in a full voice of good-natured surprise.
"Where did you come from?"
Those crewmen who were in earshot, every man aboard spoke good English, were surprised at the captain's announcement. Ugaki saw the looks. He would brief them in later.
"Didn't even tango back. I guess he wasn't a GQ," Kennedy keyed the phone again.
"As per exercise instructions, we will now pull off and turn on our augmenter." On his command, USS Asheville turned right and increased speed to 20 knots. She'd pull away to 20,000 yards to restart the exercise, giving the enemy a better chance at useful training.
"Con, sonar."
"Con I. New contact. Designate Sierra 5, bearing 280, twin-screw diesel surface ship, type unknown. Blade rate indicates about 18 knots, SM-1C, Junior Laval announced.
"No classification? Sounds a little, well, little, Captain. Not the big booming sounds of a large merchantman."
"Very well, we'll run a track. Keep me posted."
"Sonar I."
It was just too easy, Sanchez thought. The Enterprise group was probably having a tougher time with their Congo-class DDGs up north.
He was not pressing it, but holding his extended flight of four at 300 feet above the calm surface at a speed of just 400 knots. Each of the four fighter attack aircraft of Slugger Flight carried four exercise Harpoon missiles, as did the four trailing in Mauler. He checked his heads-up display for location. Data loaded into his computer only an hour before gave him a probable location for the formation, and his GPS navigation system had brought him right to the programmed place. It was time to check to see how accurate their operational intelligence was. "Mauler, this is lead popping up now." Sanchez pulled back easily on the stick. "Going active now." With the second command, he flipped on his search radar. There they were, big as hell on the display. Sanchez selected the lead ship in the formation and spun up the seeker heads in the otherwise inert missiles hanging from his wings. He got four ready lights. "This is Slugger lead. Launch, launch, launch. Rippling four vampires. Two launching four, three launch four. Four launching three, one aboard on the rail." About par for the course, Sanchez thought, framing a remark for his wing maintenance officer. In a real attack, the aircraft would have angled back down to the surface after firing their missiles so as not to expose themselves. For the purposes of the exercise, they descended to 200 feet and kept heading in to simulate their own missiles. Onboard recorders would take down the radar and tracking data from the Japanese ships in order to evaluate their performance, which so far was not impressive. Faced with the irksome necessity of allowing women to fly in real combat squadrons off real carriers, the initial compromise had been to put them in electronic warfare aircraft. Hence, the Navy's first female squadron commander was Commander Roberta Peach of VAQ-137, the Rooks. The most senior female carrier aviator, she deemed it her greatest good fortune that another naval aviator, female, already had the call sign Peaches, which allowed her to settle on Robber, a name she insisted on in the air. "Getting signals now, Robber," the lead EWO in the back of her prowler reported. "Lots of sets lighting off." "Shut 'em back down," she ordered curtly. "Sure are a lot of 'em. Targeting a harm on an SPG-51, tracking and ready." "Launching now," Robber said. Shooting was her prerogative as aircraft commander. As long as the SPG-51 missile illumination radar was up and radiating, the harm anti-radar missile was virtually guaranteed to hit. Sanchez could see the ships now, gray shapes on the visual horizon. An unpleasant screech in his headphones told him that he was being illuminated with both search and fire control radar. Never a happy bit of news, even in an exercise. All the more so that the enemy, in this case, had American-designed SM-2 standard surface-to-air missiles, with whose performance he was quite familiar. It looked like a Hatakaze class. Two SPG-51C missile radars. Only one single-rail launcher. She could guide only two at a time. His aircraft represented two missiles. The Hornet was a larger target than the Harpoon was, and was not going as low or as fast as the missile did. On the other hand, he had a protective jammer aboard, which evened the equation somewhat. Bud eased his stick to the left. It was against safety rules to fly directly over a ship under circumstances like this, and a few seconds later, he passed 300 yards ahead of the destroyer's bow. At least one of his missiles would have hit, he judged, and that one was only a 5,000-ton tin can. One Harpoon warhead would ruin her whole day, making his follow-up attack with cluster munitions even more deadly. "Slugger, this is lead. Form up on me. 2, 3, 4, his flight acknowledged. Another day in the life of a naval aviator, the CAG thought. Now he could look forward to landing, going into CIC and spending the rest of the next 24 hours going over the scores. It just wasn't very exciting anymore. He'd splashed real airplanes, and anything else wasn't the same. But flying was still flying. The roar of aircraft overhead was usually exhilarating. Sato watched the last of the gray American fighters climb away and lifted his binoculars to see their direction. Then he rose and headed below to the CIC. "Well?" he asked.
Departure course is as we thought. Fleet Ops tapped the satellite photo that showed both American battle groups still heading west into the prevailing winds to conduct flight operations. The photo was only 2 hours old. The radar plot showed the American aircraft heading to the expected point. Excellent. My respects to the captain. Make course 155 maximum possible speed. In less than a minute, Mutsu shuddered with increased engine power and started riding harder through the gentle Pacific swells for her rendezvous with the American battle force. Timing was important. On the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, a young trader's clerk made a posting error on Merck stock at exactly 11:43:02 Eastern Standard Time. It actually went onto the system and appeared on the board at 23 1/8, well off the current value. 30 seconds later, he typed it in again, inputting the same amount. This time he got yelled at. He explained that the damned keyboard was sticky and unplugged it, switching it for a new one. It happened often enough. People spilled coffee and other things in this untidy place. The correction was inputted at once and the world returned to normal. In the same minute, something similar happened with General Motors stock and someone made the same excuse. It was safe. The people at her particular kiosk didn't interact all that much with the people who did Merck. Neither had any idea what they were doing, just that they were being paid $50,000 to make an error that would have no effect on the system at all. Had they not done it, they did not know. Another pair of individuals had been paid the same amount of money to do the same thing 10 minutes later. In the Stratus mainframe computers at the Depository Trust Company, more properly in the software that resided in them, the entries were noted, and the Easter egg started to hatch. The cameras and lights were all set up in St. Vladimir Hall of the great Kremlin Palace, the traditional room for finalizing treaties, and a place that Jack had visited at another time and under very different circumstances. In two separate rooms, the President of the United States and the President of the Russian Republic were having their makeup put on, something that was probably more irksome to the Russian, Ryan was sure. Looking good for the cameras was not a traditional requirement for local political figures. Most of the guests were already seated, but the senior members of both official parties could be more relaxed. Final preparations were just about complete. The crystal glasses were on their trays, and the corks on the champagne bottles were unwrapped, awaiting only the word to be popped off. "That reminds me, you never did send me any of that Georgian champagne," Jack told Sergei. "Well, today it can be done, and I can get you a good price. You know, before I would have had to turn it in because of ethics laws." "Yes, I know that every American official is a potential crook," Golovko noted, checking around to see that everything was done properly. "You should be a lawyer." Jack saw the lead Secret Service agent come through the door and headed to his seat. "Some place, isn't it, honey?" he asked his wife. "The Tsars knew how to live," she whispered back as the TV lights all came on. In America, all the networks interrupted their regular programming. The timing was a little awkward, with the 11-hour differential between Moscow and the American West Coast. Then there was Russia, which had at least 10 time zones of its own, a result of both sheer size and, in the case of Siberia, proximity to the Arctic Circle. But this was something everyone would want to see. The two presidents came out, to the applause of the 300 people present. Roger Derling and Eduard Grushevoy met at the mahogany table and shook hands warmly, as only two former enemies could. Derling, the former soldier and paratrooper with Vietnam experience, Grushevoy, also a former soldier, a combat engineer who had been among the first to enter Afghanistan. Trained to hate one another in their youth, now they would put a final end to it all. On this day they would set aside all the domestic problems that both lived with on every day of the week. For today the world would change by their hands. Grushevoy, the host, gestured Derling to his chair, then moved to the microphone. "Mr. President," he said through an interpreter whom he didn't really need, "it is my pleasure to welcome you to Moscow for the first time." Ryan didn't listen to the speech. It was predictable in every phrase. His eyes fixed on a black plastic box that sat on the table exactly between the chairs of the two chiefs of state.
It had two red buttons and a cable that led down to the floor. A pair of TV monitors sat against the near wall, and in the rear of the room, large projection TVs were available for everyone to watch. They showed similar sights.
"Hell of a way to run a railroad," an Army major noted, 20 miles from Minot, North Dakota. He'd just screwed in the last wire.
"Okay, circuits are live, wires are hot."
Only one safety switch prevented the explosives from going, and he had his hand on it. He'd already done a personal check of everything, and there was a full company of military police patrolling the area, because Friends of the Earth was threatening to protest the event by putting people where the explosives were. And, as desirable as it might be just to blow the bastards up, the officer would have to disable the firing circuit if that happened.
Why the hell, he wondered, would anybody protest this?
He'd already wasted an hour trying to explain that to his Soviet counterpart.
"So like the steps here," the man said, shivering in the wind. They both watched a small TV for their cue.
"It's a shame we don't have the politicians around here to give us some hot air." He took his hand off the safety switch. Why couldn't they just get on with it? The Russian officer knew his American English well enough to laugh at the remark, feeling inside his oversized parka for a surprise he had in waiting for the American.
"Mr. President, the hospitality we have experienced in this great city is proof positive that there should be, can be, and will be a friendship between our two peoples, just as strong as our old feelings were, but far more productive. Today we put an end to war," Durling concluded to warm applause, returning to shake Rushavoy's hand. Both men sat down. Oddly, now they had to take their orders from an American TV director who held a headset to his face and talked very quickly.
"Now," men said in two languages, "if the audience will turn to the TVs..."
"When I was a lieutenant in the Pioneers," the Russian president whispered, "I loved blowing things up."
Durling grinned, leaning his head in close. Some things were not for microphones.
"You know the job I always wanted as a boy? Do you have it over here?"
"What is that, Roger?"
"The guy who runs the crane with the big iron ball for knocking buildings down. It has to be the best job in the whole world."
"Especially if you can put your parliamentary opposition in the building first."
It was a point of view that both shared.
"Time," Durling saw from the director. Both men put their thumbs on their buttons.
"On three, Ed?" Durling asked.
"Yes, Roger."
"One," Durling said.
"Two," Grushovoy continued.
"Three," both said, pressing them down.
The two buttons closed a simple electrical circuit that led to a satellite transmitter outside. It took roughly a third of a second for the signal to go up to the satellite and come back down, then another third for the result to retrace the same path, and for a long moment a lot of people thought that something had gone wrong. But it hadn't.
"Whoa," the major observed, when 100 pounds of composition 4 went off. The noise was impressive, even from half a mile, and there followed the tower of flame from the ignition of the solid-fuel rocket motor. That part of the ceremony had been tricky. They'd had to make sure that the thing would burn from the top only. Otherwise, the missile might have tried to fly out of the silo, and that would just not have done at all. In fact, the whole exercise was unnecessarily complicated and dangerous. The cold wind drove the toxic exhaust smoke to the east, and by the time it got to anything important, it would just be a bad smell, which was pretty much what you could say about the political conditions that had occasioned the existence of the burning rocket motor, wasn't it? There was a certain awe to it, though. The world's largest firework burning backwards for about 3 minutes before there was nothing left but smoke. A sergeant activated the silo fire suppression system, which actually worked, rather to the major's surprise.
"You know, we had a drawing to see who'd get to do this."
"I won," the officer said, getting to his feet.
"I was just ordered to come. I am glad I did. Is it safe now?"
"I think so. Come on, Valentin. We have one more job to do, don't we?"
Both men got into an HMMWV, the current incarnation of the Army Jeep, and the major started it up, heading for the silo from upwind. Now it was just a hole in the ground generating steam.
A CNN crew followed, still giving a live feed as the vehicle bumped across the uneven prairie. Their vehicle stopped 200 yards away, somewhat to their annoyance, while the two officers dismounted their vehicle, carrying gas masks against the possibility that there was still enough smoke to be a health concern. There wasn't, just the nasty smell. The American officer waved the TV crew in and waited for them to get ready. That took 2 minutes. "Ready," the unit director said. "Are we in agreement that the silo and missile are destroyed?" "Yes, we are," the Russian replied with a salute. Then he reached behind his back and pulled two crystal glasses from his pockets. "Would you hold this, please, Comrade Major?" Next came a bottle of Georgian champagne. The Russian popped the cork with a wide grin and filled both glasses. "I teach you Russian tradition now. First, you drink," he said. The TV crew loved it. "I think I know that part." The American downed the champagne. "And now?" "The glasses may never be used for a lesser purpose. Now you must do as I do." With that, the Russian turned and poised himself to hurl his glass into the empty hole. The American laughed and did the same. "Now." With that, both glasses disappeared into the last American Minuteman silo. They disappeared in the steam, but both could hear them shatter against the scorched concrete walls. "Fortunately, I have two more glasses," Valentin said, producing them. "Son of a bitch," Ryan breathed. It turned out that the American at the Russian silo had had a similar idea and was now explaining what Miller time meant. Unfortunately, aluminum cans didn't break when thrown. Overly theatrical, his wife thought. It isn't exactly Shakespeare, but if 'twere done, when 'twere done, then at least it's done, honey. Then they heard the corks popping off amid the sounds of applause. "Is the $5 billion part true?"
"Yeah."
"So, Ivan Emetovich, we can be truly friends now?" Golovko asked, bringing glasses.
"We finally meet, Caroline," he said graciously to Kathy.
"Sergei and I go way back," Jack explained, taking the glass and toasting his host.
"To the time I had a gun to your head," the Russian observed.
Ryan wondered if it were an historical reference or a toast to the event.
"What?" Kathy asked, almost choking on her drink.
"You never told her?"
"Jesus, Sergei. What are you two talking about?"
"Dr. Ryan, once upon a time your husband and I had a professional disagreement that ended up with myself holding a pistol in his face. I never told you, Jack, that the gun wasn't loaded."
"Well, I wasn't going anywhere anyway, was I?" "What are you two talking about? Is this some inside joke?" Kathy demanded.
"Yeah, honey, that's about right.
How is Andrei Ilyich doing?"
"He's well. In fact, if you would like to see him, it can be arranged."
Jack nodded.
"I like that."
"Excuse me, but who exactly are you?"
"Honey," Jack said, "this is Sergei Nikolaevich Golovko, chairman of the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service."
"KGB? You know each other?"
"Not KGB, madame. We are much smaller now. Your husband and I have been competitors for years now."
"Okay, and who won?" she asked.
Both men had the same thought, but Golovko said it first.
"Both of us, of course.
Now, if you will permit, let me introduce you to my wife, Yelena. She's a pediatrician."
That was something CIA had never bothered to find out, Jack realized. He turned to look at the two presidents, enjoying the moment, despite being surrounded by newsies. It was the first time he'd actually been to an event like this, but he was sure they weren't always this chummy. Perhaps it was the final release of all that tension, the realization that, yes, Virginia, it really was over. He saw people bringing in yet more champagne. It was pretty good stuff, and he fully intended to have his share of it. CNN would soon tire of the party, but these people would not. All the uniforms and politicians and spies and diplomats. Hell, maybe they would all really be friends.
Chapter 19. Strike 2. 1-800-RUN. Though the overall timing was fortuitous, the plan for exploiting the chance was exquisite, the product of years of study and modeling and simulation.
In fact, the operation had already begun when six major commercial banks in Hong Kong started going short on U.S. Treasury bonds. These had been bought a few weeks earlier, part of a complex exchange for yen holdings done as a classic hedge against monetary fluctuations. The banks themselves were about to undergo a trauma, a change in ownership of the very ground upon which they stood, and the two factors